Stunned silence.
Oh, yes.
So it must be doing something, right?
And it's playing its game or something.
Tell us what you mean.
I just can't
think of it. I love the enthusiasm.
Brilliant.
You're tuned to The 15th Station, New Zealand's first cafe podcast. This is episode 147 for February 2020. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, this afternoon for us. I don't know what time you're listening. We welcome back Gavin. How are you, mate?
Good, thanks, James. Happy Valentine's Day after.
Oh, why, thank you. That's very sweet of you. Lovely sentiment for you to impart. Speaking of lovely, we welcome back the lovely Anna. How are you?
Good, thank you. That was a nice little segue.
Did you like that? Seamless. It's almost like we've been doing this for 10 years. And in his own right, his own interpretation of loveliness, we always welcome back our one and only the Don. How are you, Don?
Kia ora.
Right. Well, it's great to be talking to you all. How is everyone going? How's your summer going? Are things sort of settling down there over there in Australia, guys?
Yeah, we've had a lot of rain over the last couple of weeks, which has been great. I mean, there's been a bit of flooding in the park.
We saw that, right? Gosh,
it's just it has been sort of, you know, fires one minute and rain the next,
and hail.
I was just waiting for I was just waiting for the announcement of the plague of locusts or something. I mean, it was just kind of
that's in Africa.
It felt kind of biblical.
Yeah, I mean, they honestly were forecasting rain not until sort of March or April.
Yeah.
So my garden is loving it. Like it pretty much died over December, January, but it's making a comeback now, so it's great.
New podcast coming, spin off.
I like it. The Catholic garden. Well, I mean, actually, because over here, Auckland's just declared we're in a drought. So
yeah,
we've just had 40. I think it was 40 days is the record for no rain, and with less than 1 millimeter of rain over the last 40 days. So,
very biblical.
Yes, be having sunny weather in summer is quite rare here. So, I think everyone's enjoying it. Now people are kind of, as the ground starts to, I was looking at my lawn when I went to mow it and turn it into more of a dust storm last week, and there's like big cracks in it. And I was like, not so flash. But still a bit more of summer to go, which is nice, and getting into the more relaxed part of the year, hopefully. Plenty to cover off on this month's episode. We'll start with an exhortation, because that's always a good place to start. This is from Catholic News Service. Pope Francis said he dreams of an Amazon region where the rights of the poor and indigenous are respected, local cultures are preserved, nature is protected, and the Catholic Church is present and active with Amazonian features. In his apostolic exhortation, Querida Amazonia, beloved Amazonia, or beloved Amazon, I guess, Pope Francis made no mention of the idea of ordaining married men to the priesthood so that far-flung Catholic communities would have regular access to the Eucharist. Instead, he said, every effort should be made to ensure that the Amazonian people do not lack this food of new life and the sacrament of forgiveness. A specific and courageous response is required of the Church to meet the needs of Catholics, he said, without dictating what response that would be. Having a church with Amazonian features, he said, would also require greater efforts to evangelize, official recognition of the role women have and continue to play in the region's Catholic communities, a respect for popular forms of piety, and greater efforts to enculturate the Catholic faith in Amazonian cultures. The Pope devoted several long passages to the theme of enculturation, the process by which the faith becomes incarnate in a local church, taking on local characteristics that are in harmony with the faith and giving the local culture values and traits that come from the universal church. There is a risk, he said, that evangelizers who come to a particular area may think that they must not only communicate the gospel, but also the culture in which they grew up. Instead, he said, what is needed is courageous openness to the novelty of the Spirit, who is always able to create something new with the inexhaustible riches of Jesus Christ. Well, that set off some alarm bells over there in Canberra. Gavin, what did you make of the Pope's exhortation on the Amazon?
I thought it was, it was very highly anticipated because there had been all this discussion about married priests or women deacons or other things. I think often the contents of apostolic exhortations or encyclicals or other papal documents highlighted for what they don't say rather than what they do say. I think there is a, you know, there's a lot of very interesting stuff in there, and there's a lot of, maybe more so in Australia than in New Zealand, some parallels around a lot of the stuff around Indigenous communities, Indigenous cultures, and, you know, Australia being a very large country with, you know, huge swathes of desert and what have you. There are some pretty remote areas where sometimes the faith isn't, or access to the sacraments, for example, isn't as accessible. But there, so there was a bit of interest from parts of Australia, I think, as to what might happen there. But I think, you know, it was interesting. One of the things that that was mentioned was the fact that there was, in parts of Latin America, they're sending priests off to other parts of the world when there are people in the Amazon who don't have access to the sacraments because there aren't enough priests to go around. And it makes you think, okay, well, so if priests from Latin America are going to Europe or other places or North America, it's sort of like, you know, really? Shouldn't they be staying at home? And, you know, or in their region? And one of the things that Pope Francis spoke about was the need for bishops around the world to be generous and for missionary priests to be generous in their interest in going to somewhere like the Amazon to provide the Eucharist and to provide the sacrament of confession to those communities. And I think that the focus on what's not said in the document is a little bit frustrating because it leads people not to read the document, which does have a lot of richness in it around around the faith, around the challenges that the Amazon faces in terms of ecology and in terms of the treatment of Indigenous peoples. And, you know, people just focus on their own little hobby horses, which doesn't lead to an openness to read what the Holy Father has to say and how it might be applicable to their own lives.
And I mean, speaking of that, that openness to that or closing off because people just wanted to see a response to one particular topic, of course, Anna, was that people were expecting, given all the hubbub and discussion earlier on about a proclamation on married priests in that part of the world, and no real mention of it at all. What did you make of that?
I'm glad it didn't become the sort of central focus of the document itself. And I think, you know, when the synod was on and, you know, there were lots of discussions, obviously, about women deacons, married priesthood. And I really felt that what was really called for was a response by the Universal Church to go to the Amazon. And I see that, you know, in the document that there is a call, not just for missionary priests, but missionaries to go there and to witness to the faith among the people there and help them to build it, build up the church in that place. And I believe that the church can do that because it's, the church has done that in our own countries, right? Australia and New Zealand were, and still are, on the edges of the earth, you know, and a couple of hundred years ago, missionaries were coming to our countries and sharing faith and sharing the gospel and helping the church to grow in those places. So, and they were able to do that without having married priests and women deacons. So I think, you know, it's possible to do that. And I think it was only going to, if they did decide to do the married priests, you know, it was only going to be a very sort of narrow and temporary solution and not an ongoing permanent fixture. And we want the Amazon to, and the church in the Amazon to reflect the universal church as well, but obviously have its own culture in to a certain degree. And and I think the whole enculturation idea is actually very difficult. And I think, you know, perhaps in Australia and in New Zealand, we've had difficulties, a variety of difficulties of really understanding, like, how is that lived out? And, you know, little token gestures of cultural stuff may not be the way forward, but, you know, like, I think that's the tension in any place that where the church goes and is trying to perhaps be alive there amongst the culture of the place. And you know, some I think too in South America there is you know, in some parts a lot of the church practices, the local people, like they've had perhaps a lot of like superstition, kind of a culture based a lot on superstition. And sometimes when the church has gone in there, a lot of the church practices become sort of, you know, that becomes apparent in some of the church practices as well. And right. I think perhaps that's in South America, at least that's a danger. But yeah, anyway, I think that's...
Like we spoke about that, didn't we, in some of what James read out about, you know, the need for the appropriate enculturation.
Yes, the appropriate enculturation, yeah. Because it is one of those challenges, I guess, and I think particularly when you're talking, and it's not just, that's not an Amazonian thing, that's a cultures around the world thing.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. You look at enculturation, I mean, Rome is filled with that exact, the enculturation. Christmas is an example of enculturation. You know, there's a number of examples of it throughout the world, really. So it is to do that to appropriate levels. Don, what about you, mate? What did you make of this exhortation? I mean, were you surprised that the Pope didn't make a comment on married priests? Are you surprised on the enculturation comments? Are you surprised at all?
I'm relieved because there was a strong indication that he was going to make some comments. And when you have publications like the NCR and the American Jesuit publication, and they're very annoyed with the publication and the lack of mention or the lack of change, so that's probably a good thing because they're a bunch of heretics. On the kind of enculturation side, yeah, it's around specifics, and I wish that the Pope would have been more specific around what specifics can be incorporated into our faith and what can't. Obviously, the Pachamama, that's not compatible with our faith. Yeah, if you look at something on the Maori side for our indigenous people, if we're incorporating things like Tane into our discussions on Catholicism, then that's probably not a good thing either. So being more specific around those and being more Catholic around those, the Pope probably should have given a bit more guidance. But yeah, the fact that he didn't ruin the church is fantastic.
You know, I think being a bit dramatic, a penchant for the dramatic there, Don, with ruin the church?
No, I think, yeah, if he had come out with... I think there would have been a strong case for schism, like
on Mary priests.
Yeah, I think there's a strong case for schism if it did come out on the Mary priests. I don't know. You disagree because you think that there's a historical context there. I think that the disciples were married before, but I think they were abstinent. So, I think there's a continuity there, and definitely, yeah, there is a case for, certainly from the conservatives' perspective, a case for schism.
I mean, I can definitely see the case for schism on female priests. That's pretty obvious to me. I struggle a little bit more with schism, which is obviously, you know, worst case scenario from our point of view, on Mary priests, given that for nearly half the church's history we had Mary priests.
The two are interrelated. It's the Mary priest scenario is a segue to that, and you look at what happened in the Anglican Church. It's a segue.
It wasn't a segue for us for the first like 1100 years, was it?
It hasn't been a segue for the Orthodox.
I don't know. I mean, I get what you're saying when it's connected. It can be connected to a theology or to an interpretation that can lead down a path of, okay, well now we're redefinition and we can just keep rolling. I get that.
Yeah.
But hence why, particularly when we talk about female priests, because you get back to the personhood of Christ and everything else, we know that, as you say, a number of the apostles were married and then they, at least according to scripture, you know, left that behind. Whether they then continued to be abstinent forever, we don't know. But I think you would assume they would. But I don't know. I think just because the church...
I think that's a pretty good assumption.
Hey, what's that?
I think that's a pretty strong assumption.
Yeah, which is fine. And then, but I think that the fact that the church had married priests for so many hundreds of years, I don't know. I've always kind of looked at this going, I'm not as fussed on married priests. I think, as we've talked about on previous episodes, I think there are practical and logistical challenges as a married man myself. I think I would struggle to try and, you know, between my vocation, but have two vocations at the same time. But I mean, obviously the Orthodox Church and others do it, and the Anglicans and others do it. How effectively they do that, I don't know. So I don't know. It is one of those ones where I just think the thing I guess I'm reacting to is there's the word of schism. I'm like, oh gosh, that feels like quite an extreme reaction to something which at some point for nearly half the church's history was the norm.
I don't believe it was a norm. I believe that there were people who were married, who were ordained, and then gave up. Yeah, basically were abstinent. So I think that's a different thing.
But was that?
And maybe the more appropriate word is abstinent rather than married.
Maybe. I didn't know that was what the call was for the first, like while it was in the church. Like if you became a priest when you were married in the church, were you called to be abstinent from that point?
I believe so. The
vow of celibacy, I thought, Well, anyway, this has been an interesting chat. Don, we just have a chat afterwards, actually, and so I'll try and find out some more about it because you've got me thinking, which is what we want on this podcast. Let's talk about this next one around what is also wanted in New Zealand. From the New Zealand Catholic Bishops Conference, Cardinal John Dew has urged New Zealanders on Waitangi Day to recommit to protecting the beliefs of followers of all religions and of non-religious people. While giving the homily at the Interdenominational Church Service at Waitangi on February the 6th, Cardinal John Dew recalled the Christchurch Mosque's massacre last March and said New Zealand's tradition of religious freedom was first affirmed at the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi in 1840. Quote, "It is time to recommit ourselves to protecting the faiths of all who live here, of Māori custom and spirituality, of the different Christian denominations, of Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, Baha'i, and many other faiths, and also the freedom of religion and conscience to those who do not, who profess no faith," Cardinal Dew told the service at Te Whare Runanga. Cardinal Dew said that much discussion in recent years focused narrowly on whether New Zealand was a secular country where religion was not part of the public sphere, or whether it was a Christian country where only one form of public prayer should be privileged. But our heritage was religious tolerance, religious inclusion, and religious acceptance. Quote, "I am a Christian. I preach Christ, who offers and brings salvation to all humanity," he said. "Christians do not want to be less than we are. We do not want to be silenced or marginalized, to be told that the faith that gives us life is just a private matter. Neither do we want any other religious groups or people of goodwill who do not identify with any religion to be marginalized, silenced, or told their beliefs are only private matters." At the signing of the Treaty of in 1840, Bishop Jean-Baptiste Pompelier, the first Catholic bishop of New Zealand, asked the representative of the British Crown, Captain William Hobson, for religious freedom to be respected. Hobson formally affirmed, and I will not try and butcher the Te Reo, I could but I won't, "the several faiths of England, of the Wesleyans, of Rome, and also Māori custom shall alike be protected. Here at Waitangi on 6 February 1840, there was a hope, wishes, a vision of what Aotearoa New Zealand could be," said Cardinal Dew, adding that religious freedoms were also affirmed in the first debate in the new colonial parliament in 1854. "It is good that we look here to Waitangi, where in these first sacred discussions about the way to live in partnership with each other, my predecessor, Bishop Pompelier, asked for and received a guarantee of religious freedom and protection." So, Anna, did you know about this being enshrined in the Treaty of Waitangi, first of all, this kind of freedom of religion? And then what do you make of the Cardinal's comments at this this speech last week?
Yeah, no, I didn't know, but I'm not surprised that it was. Look, I'm glad to hear the Cardinal standing up for religious freedom and religious freedom for everybody. It's one of those things where, and he did use the term, and we do use it, and, you know, the whole idea of tolerance. And I think we've perhaps distorted what tolerance actually means in this day and age. But I think the thing is that when you have a country with people who have many different beliefs, there is a tension there. And I think we have to just face up to the fact that, yeah, it's not easy living with people and getting on with your everyday life, and also making, maybe on a political level, making legislation and things like that. You know, there is a tension when you have differences of belief and therefore the way in which you might live your life and things like that. And part of me is like, it's not about tolerance. It's actually about just, I think the only way to get through it is to encourage the goodwill of the other person, you know? So I'm not trying to pursue my own good for myself, you know, in a selfish manner, but, you know, I hope for the good for everyone. And not just I tolerate your religion in my country or something like that, you know? And that's not an easy thing to do. Like, that's a real sort of, you have to sacrifice things, or you know, it means that you have to learn how to debate or argue properly, or it means that, yeah, perhaps in a, on a level of getting to know someone or friendship, that perhaps you go through a time of tension and difficulty, but that doesn't have to be the end of it, but that, you know, you persevere through that. And I think we've just, you know, we don't really understand how to live in a country or in a world where lots of people have different ideas. I mean, it's always been the case in the world because it's been full of people who think differently. But, you know, how do we do that now without marginalizing anyone? But also that, you know, we can, I think it's a good thing. There's a potential for us to grow as human beings and grow in our respective faith and things like that. But I think it's more about, it's not about tolerance as such. It's about, well, do I wish good for the other person, and therefore my actions should reflect that. And that doesn't necessarily, especially for us Christians, that's not a diminishing of our faith. That's actually a living out of our faith. So, and I can't say the same for other religions, but certainly, you know, I'm sure that there would be some element of that in there. So that would be my take.
It's a good take. I mean, it is one of those things where it's trying to find that balance, right, between tolerance and at the same time watering down what you already represent, which is, I guess, the one of the interesting angles there where Cardinal Jew says, you know, I am Christian, I preach Christ. Christians do not want to be less than we are or to be silenced or marginalized. You know, it is that point around, okay, we should be able to believe what we believe, but in a pluralistic society, you can't expect that everyone's going to believe what you believe. And then how do you tolerate each other? And yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. Don, what did you make of either what the Cardinal said or, you know, the comments on what the Treaty of Waitangi represents?
Oh, I think the comments are really relevant at this time. I'm a little bit surprised. I'm happily surprised that the Cardinal has brought this up. Because there is a very militant neo-Marxist leftism that's creeping up on us. You know, if you believe in traditional marriage these days, if you give to traditional marriage, if you think that homosexuality is sinful, you've branded these things like a bigot or a hater. You know, very few people in this whole debate or who have that view of traditional marriage actually hate LGBT people. This is the kind of culture that we're living in, that if you have these beliefs, suddenly you're a hater. And in the public sphere, you've seen the issue around Israel Folau losing his job because of those beliefs. You have, you know, with that the US chicken chain, Chick-fil-A, massive protests disrupting the openings in various locations around the world because the founder was Christian and had Christian values. He doesn't open on Sunday, but more importantly, he had those Christian values and a support of traditional marriage, and supported institutions like the Samaritan Army, who also have those Christian values. So it's incredibly under attack at the moment. It's incredibly relevant. And yeah, I wish that the Cardinal would speak of this more.
Oh, that's good. Pleasantly surprised on the first two stories, Don. Might be a record. I have to look through from previous episodes. Gavin, what about you, mate? What did you make of this? Especially the point around how you balance between, you know, evangelizing on one side and tolerating on the other. How does that sort of work out for you, or what did you think of the Cardinals' comments in general?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very hot-button issue in Australia at the moment, and there's a back and forth around should there be Religious Freedom or Religious Discrimination Act or religious freedom legislation in Australia. So it's a big issue here at the moment as well, and the bishops have spoken a fair bit about it, probably in a slightly different context, but certainly in the face of the sorts of attitudes that Don spoke about in his typically eloquent way. So I think it is important to speak out. I was unaware of this. I wrote some stories about the Treaty of Waitangi and the church's involvement maybe 15 years ago, not quite, but so it was, I remember reading it then and being surprised about it. That we probably read it through the lens also, the historical lens of Bishop Pompallier as a Catholic that seemed to be a little bit on the outer at the time, trying to make sure that the Catholics got in there and were treated the same as some of the others. So the risk of raining on Pompallier's parade, there probably was a self-serving aspect to it, but clearly he sought to have religious freedom for people of all backgrounds, not just Catholics. But that it did get up, and while it's, you know, I think the three of you all weren't aware of it, and, you know, very, you know, by general public standards, very knowledgeable people around the church and culture. So I probably that tells us that it's a greatly unknown aspect of the treaty itself and of Pompallier's contribution to it. So maybe this is a catalyst for better understanding of it.
Yeah, that's a really fair point, Gavin. And I think one of the things about Pompallier, I mean, I think I may have mentioned on a podcast towards the end of last year when we went on a family holiday and went to Russell and Waitangi in that area, and sort of went to the Pompallier's the Catholic mission there, and just learned a whole bunch of things about the Catholic aspects of our history, which it was interesting. I didn't really know, or maybe I had dim recollection from when I was a schoolboy. But the sense of, I mean, you think about 1840, you think about what was going on in that part of the world, in that time in the world, in the West, and then you think about the kind of almost collision of different missionaries coming into New Zealand at the same time, and then the challenges, obviously, with enculturation would be a way too polite way to call some of what was going on. So it is quite, I find it quite affirming to know that that's what's in our one of our founding documents. And to have the Cardinal calling it out, I think, well done to him. Well done to him. It's good to sort of know these aspects about your history. So we'll move on to this next one from the NZ Herald. The number of New Zealand women choosing a life of religion in the Catholic Church is dwindling. Yeah, I think they mean a religious life in the Catholic Church, but we'll get into that. Figures from the Vatican Directory show there are only 182 Catholic sisters across the country. That's, you know, capital, so proper noun sisters, so nuns. Numbers include 77 in Auckland, 9 in Hamilton, 18 in Palmerston North, and 58 in the capital. In the South Island, 16 nuns reside in Christchurch, while Dunedin hosts only 4. One of those 4 is St. Joseph's sister Anne Gilroy. She believed young women these days don't find the church an easy place to be. Quote, women have far more options of belonging to groups or professions that help change the world than they did in my time, she said. Historian Professor Peter Lynham said the numbers are in stark contrast to those of the past. 50 years ago, every Catholic family felt obligated to supply at least one daughter to a religious order, and ideally one of their sons to be a priest, he said. It is a very telling reflection of different conceptions of both the role of religion and its significance, and also the ways that religion gets expressed. For example, there are many devout Catholics today who would never, ever consider the possibility of entering a religious order. Recently, the Vatican women's magazine, Women Church World, blamed the decline in numbers worldwide in part to working conditions and abuses of power. Anna, what do you make of this? I mean, as obviously you have a perspective on this that the three men on the podcast do not. So what is your sort of take when you look at the numbers? And I mean, the headline that even the news itself is probably not news, but maybe some of the analysis that did that spark anything in you?
Yeah, I thought the analysis was actually particularly out of touch with young women. So it actually just so happened that I was reading an article about a week ago, I think, on the worldwide numbers of religious sisters. So, you know, we can look back over the last sort of 30, 40 years and see there was a real crisis in religious life. The numbers dropped dramatically across the world. And like that's definitely true. That's happened. But in fact, it seems that certainly the last 5 years to 10 years that the decline is actually halted. So, of course, if you compare how many sisters we have now to, you know, 40 years ago, there's, you know, we have a lot less. But the decline has stopped. And in fact, it's almost going in the opposite direction now. So that potentially hasn't reached New Zealand yet. but I'm part of, like, my generation. If I look at my friends and who are ladies in the Catholic Church, like, and even myself, like, I certainly discerned religious life in my 20s. Excuse me. And I know many of my Catholic friends did. That was something one, you know, did. You know, you prayed about what your vocation was and you took that seriously. And so I know many people, many women who have discerned religious life, and then some have gone on to join religious communities, and some have even, and a slightly less number, have actually remained and now are fully professed or perpetually professed. But except for perhaps one, they have all been to religious orders that we do not have in New Zealand. So there are New Zealand women joining religious orders, but they're not our local ones. And I think, you know, part of that is perhaps I think the orders that are getting vocations at the moment generally are the newer ones. Some of the older orders are still, like Carmelites are still getting religious vocations and things like that, and they've been around for a very long time. And perhaps orders like the Dominicans are getting new vocations, but they're often to new communities that have sprung out of like the Dominican or the Benedictine communities. So they're new communities being made. And, you know, I think that a lot of the religious orders that remain in New Zealand, they came out to New Zealand. It was on the, like I've already said today, like it was the edge of the world, and they came out, and it was like, it was really radical. It was a real adventure. And they started up schools and hospitals, and they did, it was a real adventure to belong to. And it's not the same anymore in those religious orders. They're mostly out of schools these days, or perhaps they just have some kind of governing involvement, and they're pretty much out of hospitals these days as well. So, you know, what do they do? A friend of mine looked into a religious order that was based in New Zealand, and she did some sort of spent some time with them, and they said to her, "Oh, what kind of career do you want?" And she's like, I'm not here for a career. Like, this is the whole point of religious life, is that it's not a career, it's a way of life. But that was their focus, was they all had their own careers. They went out to work every day, and they all did something different. And she's just like, that's not what I imagine religious life to be. So I think part of it is that what we have in New Zealand is not attractive to young people, but that young people are actually exploring that their vocation and being open to, you know, what that might look like. But often it ends up being overseas, especially in the case for religious life for women.
Mm. And it's one of those things, I really appreciate your perspective on it, because it's one of those things where I did feel, you know, I was reading through the article and I was like, yeah, the obligations, Gavin, you know, the obligations that every Catholic family felt to supply at least one daughter and one son, you know, wasn't that the thing? Like the first son was for the farm and second son was for the church and then the rest was spare. Well, I think there was some rhyme about that in Ireland in the, you know, hundreds of years ago. But what did you make of you know, Professor Peter Lynham, who we've spoken about a lot because he is quite he's often quoted in terms of research when it comes to particularly religious history in New Zealand. But what did you make of the separation there, especially when you compare it to exactly what Anna was saying around maybe it's not some of the local orders or it isn't quite as obvious as it might first seem, but particularly that and the decline in numbers in general?
Yeah, I think Anna was making the point about that sort of adventure or whatever it was for, say, the Mercy Sisters, who originated in Ireland, or some of the other religious congregations from France, say, that came to New Zealand. There was that sense of adventure, and I think, I don't know if she used the word now or when we were speaking earlier about sort of being quite radical in that adventurous type sense. And what I observe now, I think, is there is that sort of sense of what now people will say, oh, that's sort of traditional orders or whatever, and they might wear the habit or whatever it might be. But in a sense, it's come full circle because that's almost what's radical now, that sense of, say those who choose to go into a contemplative order now, like the Carmelites or we have friends who are in other contemplative orders. That's a very radical thing to do in a culture that says, you know, immerse yourself in stimulus as often as you can, whether that's devices or you know, engaging with other people. So the thought of going to some sort of contemplative prayerful life is very radical in today's society. You know, the Sisters of Life, founded in New York by former Cardinal O'Connor. You know, the pro-life mindset is in many ways radical in today's culture. And so those, you know, that order has flourished, and at least one I know of, New Zealand woman in there. I know of a couple of, young Australian women who have joined that order. So yeah, it's sort of come full circle. And I think the reality is that numbers are much fewer than they were, you know, in most vocations within the church. Certainly a lot fewer priests, a lot fewer religious brothers. I mean, when we talk about the drop off from religious sisters, I think it's even more dramatic among religious brothers. So there was this great decline after the Second Vatican Council for a range of reasons, including priests who left because they had this, you know, speaking about the exhortation, had this hope or expectation that they'd be able to get married because the Second Vatican Council was going to change that. And they were disappointed and left, and many of them married after leaving the priesthood. So there has been this decline, but there is this almost counterculturalism now that's, I think that, you know, seminarians, we see there's been a big increase in the number of seminarians in places like Australia and even New Zealand in the last 15 years. Still in New Zealand, the numbers are small. In Australia, larger. Maybe I think there's a few more men coming from overseas into seminaries in Australia. But, there is this changing of the tide, I think. And one of the things that would be interesting is to know of that number of religious women in New Zealand. I suspect a lot of them are in their twilight, let's say, as well. So I suspect if numbers were all we looked at, and again, Anna's spoken about the fact that some New Zealand women are joining orders overseas and they're not captured by that count. If we're looking just at raw numbers, it's going to get worse before it gets better in New Zealand, just demographically speaking.
Yeah.
But there is a... there is a sense that I have that that vocational aspect remains, and while it may not always be lived out in religious life, in fact, it's rarely lived out in religious life, there is a sense that women and men are thinking about vocations, and just because they don't end up entering religious life, as you say, James, this idea of, you know, there's not a life of religion for young women in New Zealand. You know, there's often a deep religious connection that may just not be in profession or consecrated life.
Yeah, I think that's probably the thing that stuck out to me the most is that you're stringing a long bow if you start saying, oh, and no, they don't even consider it, because of course we're in the minds of all Catholics and we can tell you what they consider. I mean, pretty much everyone I know of my generation who are practicing in their faith, and we're practicing in their faith, men or women, in their, you know, teens and 20s, especially if they're involved in youth ministry and things like that, you ask the question of yourself and of God and what was being called for in your life. So the fact that hasn't resulted in professions in the same way, especially given this, and that was kind of what I was hinting at with that obligation comment, especially given that some, I'm not at all challenging or questioning anyone's vocation. I just want to point that out for the record. That being said, some may have where it was more a societal push towards. So if we end up with a smaller, more faithful church, that means that some people may not have that push to get them into making a profession. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know. I think there's, you know, arguments both ways. Don, what do you make of all of this? So the number of religious sisters are on the decline. You know, you look at these kind of numbers and you go, yep, we know that. And exactly what Gavin and Anna have both spoken about. What's your sort of take on all of this?
I think there's a real decline in Catholic education of, you know, the metaphysical and the sacramental aspects of our faith, and really in favor of the kind of pastoral aspects. And if I were a harsh man, I'd basically say something that the mission of the church today is kind of like a glorified kind of NGO, which is very physical and very temporal. And you can do a lot of those things without entering religious life. You can, you know, work for World Vision and get married and have kids and whatever. So I think because of that lack of education that, around the sacramental and metaphysical aspects of our faith, it really marginalizes the role of religious life and contemplative life and prayer life. So the key really is to get back into that education. You look in areas of the world who are Orthodox, who do emphasize the sacramental aspects of our faith, and they're booming in terms of both admissions to the seminary and to religious orders for women as well.
Well, there you go. Good point. I think the thing about, I mean, at least you're not a harsh man, but like the good thing about we are, sometimes the risk when you lean too much towards the social justice is becoming an NGO, and there is something more to us than that. Right, well, moving on then, this is from the ABC Australia covering the Pope doing some renovations, but not as you might think. A 19th century palace in prime position in the centre of the Vatican has been converted into a homeless shelter on Pope Francis's orders. Palazzo Migliori. That's totally how the original Italians would say it, which was constructed in the early 1800s, served as the headquarters of the all-female, is that Calasanzian?
Calasanziane,
of course, Italian. Calasanziane religious order, which used the building to care for young single mothers. After occupying the building for 70 years, the order relocated to new premises last year, and the palace was renovated, leading to questions about how it would be used. Sitting on prime real estate just off St. Peter's Square, the building could have generated significant income for the Catholic Church as a luxury hotel, but Pope Francis had other intentions. On its news website, Vatican News, the Vatican said Pope Francis personally directed his Almona Cardinal Conrad Krajewski, which is basically his officer in charge of distributing services to the poor, to convert it into a homeless shelter. The four-story building will house around 50 men and women, although the 16-bedroom facility has capacity for more during cold winter temperatures. The lower levels will be used to provide social support to the occupants, including computing, reading, recreation, and psychological counselling. I pronounced all those names way better in rehearsal. Gavin, what did you make of this move by the Pope on a prime piece of real estate being used to help shelter the homeless?
Oh, pretty hard to come up with too much criticism of that, I would say. Some of our stories invite rigorous debate. I'm not sure this is going to be one of those. I think you know, Don was pleasantly surprised with the Pope's apostolic exhortation. This sort of action, fits in very nicely with Pope Francis's, you know, recent history since he became Pope of important and certainly not hollow gestures. This is, you know, like when he brought a family back from Lesbos, I think it was, when he visited there, a refugee family. You know, when he does this sort of thing to show those, you know, corporal works of mercy alongside the spiritual works that he also undertakes, obviously. But, yeah, I mean, I often think about this when, you know, we've got this plenary council going on in Australia at the moment, so it's a chance for people to sort of contemplate the future of the church in hopefully a prayerful way. But one of the things that I know that there's a group of high school students in sort of regional Western Australia. I've heard the story of one of the people there, one of the, you know, sort of 17-year-old, 18-year-old young women, getting up and speaking on behalf of her classmates and saying, you know, we've got all these churches in our town and we've got homeless people in our town. Why can't we open them up to homeless people? And, you know, sure, there's a lot of very, you know, practical reasons why not. But, you know, the sense of how many buildings do we have? And, you know, you could say, well, why aren't our churches open for people to pray in more often? You know, often they're closed except when there's mass on. But how are we using our buildings, whether they're the churches or our church halls or various other places, how are we using them for good? So I guess it asks that bigger question, which doesn't, you know, have easy answers. But, you know, when you have the ability to say, I decree Cardinal Krajewski that you turn this into a homeless shelter and you're the Pope, it's probably going to happen. And, you know, if a bishop decided that he wanted to turn churches that were no longer necessary for mass into a homeless shelter,
yeah,
I'd be all for it.
Yep. Anna, what do you make of this?
Oh, yeah, like, it's great. Like, obviously, perhaps it's obviously a building that has been used for the last little while as a place for people in need. So obviously the last 70 years being for women. Now for the homeless. And let's face it, Rome has a pretty bad homeless situation. So any help that the Pope can offer in that, I think, is great. And also, I think I like the idea that it's, you know, it's in the vicinity of the Vatican, right? Like it was in the Vatican. And so there's a lot of beauty there and, I don't know, religious zeal and things like that. And so it's not just providing perhaps meals and a place to sleep for these people, but also hope in salvation and in eternal life and things like that, I think, you know, which is something also that's necessary for us. So, and yeah, it does, this kind of thing doesn't surprise me because this Pope is very much talking to us about, you know, how do we care for the poor and reach out to the poor, and he's walking the talk as well, walking the walk. Yeah. So that's good.
Don, what about you, mate? What do you make of using church property in this way?
Oh, I think I'll go back to my previous comments around the church really needs to step away from being a glorified NGO. Just look at the numbers. Like, if you've got 50 rooms in that place and presumably you can charge, what, 100, 200 euros a night, you can do a lot more in terms of the numbers than providing the direct accommodation. If you did open up a hotel or something of that sort, you could have, like, you can help a lot more than 50 people. It's not a bad thing per se, but I'd challenge the emphasis. The Pope needs to follow up and look after the salvation and the souls of those 50. And what's he doing in that respect? Because ultimately, okay, yeah, housing homeless people, good, but penultimately, he's responsible for the souls of all Catholics and presumably everyone on the planet, and bringing as many of those souls to eternal salvation as possible.
I mean, there's an element of, well, I mean, it's more than symbolism, obviously, but it does send a signal about priorities and importance and doing what Christ called. I think your point is valid, though, that the church really has to always take the bigger picture. And when you think about, Caritas and other organizations that are, have this opportunity to affect positively the lives of millions of people, that's kind of the argument I often make when people go, oh, the church is so rich. And I go, no, the church has got a lot of land and assets, and then using those assets for the betterment of all souls is really what it's called to do. But I mean, I don't know. It's good. I mean, better than people, especially if it was just sitting vacant, and people are, it can get quite cold during winter there, having homeless people who need help. I don't know. I think it's a good idea. I don't know how scalable it is. I guess your point as well, Don. Shall we move on to protecting people who believe things? This is from the Huffington Post. A UK judge has ruled that people who identify as ethical vegans... Is there such a thing as non-ethical vegans?
Well, yes, people who just eat vegan, like a vegan diet for health.
Right.
Is one thing. But ethical vegans.
I get it. They're into the philosophy behind veganism. Okay, right. Sorry. Just as interesting when I read it as ethical.
Yeah.
How do you tell if someone is vegan? They'll tell you.
Yeah, okay. Ethical vegans deserve just as much legal protection from discrimination as those who follow a traditional religion, Don. This is a landmark decision that was issued by Tribunal Judge Rod Bimpostel in Norwich in January. Suggests that the ethical veganism practiced by complainant Geordie Kasamjana, is a philosophical belief covered by the UK's Equality Act 2010 and anti-discrimination law. The decision helped establish the foundation of a case that Kasamjana is still pursuing against his former employer, the League Against Cruel Sports. Kasamjana claims he was fired because of his ethical veganism, an allegation the league disputes. Kasamjana said he is extremely happy with the outcome of the hearing. He said he's heard from many other ethical vegans who have also experienced discrimination. For ethical vegans, adopting a vegan lifestyle means much more than making changes to one's diet. See if I just read the rest of the article. In addition to avoiding eating food derived from animals, ethical vegans also refuse to purchase animal-based products such as leather or fur, or support companies that test their products on animals. Okay, I got you now. I actually know some people for whom this is, it is more than just the food. It's the full way of the treatment and products of animals. Better protection means more vegans will be able to be open about their beliefs, Kasamjana said in a statement published by his legal team. This can only be a good thing for the billions of animals still exploited by humans and environment under duress and stressed public health. So, being an ethical vegan, according to this judge in Norwich, deserves as much protection as any other traditional religion. I wonder how they'll respond to the comparison there about whether they'd consider themselves religious. I don't know. What did you guys make of this? Are any of you ethical vegans that I don't know about?
No. Negative, Ghost Rider.
No, not so much. Don, I don't know if you're... I don't want to presuppose, but I would have hazard a guess you're probably not an ethical vegan.
I'm probably... What's the exact opposite of ethical vegan?
A carnivore.
Carnivore.
Yeah, an ethical carnivore. I think I think that people who believe strongly about the rights of animals and the protection of animals are entitled to those beliefs, absolutely. And I don't think that people should be discriminated for that. I do find it interesting. I mean, I don't know the details of the case, right? Like what the discrimination for be when he was working for the League Against Cruel Sports. Like you would think that would be quite aligned with ethical things.
All over horse racing and stuff, right?
Yeah, but it's against that stuff, right? Like it's League Against Cruel Sports. Yeah. So he'd be like, you would think there would be, that would be quite compatible.
I wonder which part. Maybe they were against cruel sports, but in favor of beef burgers.
Right.
And this person wasn't in favor of beef burgers.
But I mean, I know it's our light story, but sort of the bigger question for me is where do you stop or start with protection for different ideas and saying that they, the Equality Act of 2010, the anti-discrimination law in the UK, saying that veganism does vegetarianism, I guess. I mean, it's, maybe it's the ethical aspect of it that makes it a belief set. I don't know. This is an this is a thought probe of this one, Gavin.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. If you're the, like, the receptionist and you have to provide, you know, lunches for the team, then you refuse to basically purchase lunches for the, yeah. The devil's in the detail, but if you're the receptionist and you have to buy stuff for the team and the rest of the team isn't vegan or vegetarian, and then basically you refuse to do that on the basis or the grounds that it's got meat in it, then how is that protected? Because you're basically unable to do your job, because part of your job is to buy lunch for the team.
Interesting. Many layers. Is this what you thought about when you put this in the lineup, Gavin? You're like, this will...
I did, yeah. Many layers of vegan cheese. It does actually get to an interesting point around, you know, one of the topics earlier, like around religious freedom, right? So when I said that there's a big discussion in Australia at the moment, building off the back of Don's point, one of it is, one of the things is around the employment. If you're a... if you're a gardener in a Catholic school, if you're a teacher in a Catholic school, is it okay for you to hold views in a public sense, and how you define public is probably a grey area, but in a public sense, hold views that are against the church? I don't know, did we speak about Israel Folau's cousin?
That he also
did. He was a Catholic school because he said some things that were pretty anti-Catholic in a very public way. Now, there is a sense in which an employer or an organisation has to be able to somehow police that. And Don, I'm not sure whether you were hypothesising around whether that was this person's job, but I think that's that.
No, he I don't have details. So definitely hypothesis.
Yeah, I mean, You would get to a point, I guess, if you keep going down this path of, you know, protecting all beliefs and everything in the same way, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but if you do go down that path, you are left. I'm not going to do Goblin's Law. What I was going to say is more like Don's example of the the person at work who is ethical vegan, but then is being told as part of their job, you know, to organise catering for all diets or something, and struggles with that. Like, at what point do you start saying, or your example of the gardener, you know, you're going to be working for a Catholic school. If you have an issue with the way the church honors the saints and things with, statues, you don't get to opt out of mowing the lawn around the statues. You know, you've still got to, you've got to keep the statues clean, even if you don't, you know, there has to be something where you're saying, we're not going to discriminate against you if you're not Catholic and you want to be work as a gardener in our school. But part of the job is going to mean you're going to be cleaning, you know, statues. So you need to be cool with that. Like,
but the slippery slope is when they go, okay, you're a doctor, you work for the state because you've got single payer, taxpayer funded healthcare, and we expect part of that role to be abortion referrals and bollocks like that.
So then you have the. So I was thinking about that because I was thinking about, what about the case of, you know, if you hold it, you're pro-abortion or you're anti-abortion, and, you know, you're working somewhere and get fired because of that stance. I'm not necessarily in a hospital or whatever, but there has to be a difference when a religious institution, and that could be any kind of religious institution, employs a person. There's perhaps, like, so maybe we come back to, is ethical veganism the same as a religious belief? And I don't think they're not. I think they're actually quite different. So in a religious context, there is a certain level of adherence to whatever, and, you know, like, obviously if you accept a job in a Catholic school, there's a certain level of adherence, whether you're Catholic or not, you know, that you follow. But when it's, say, something like Rugby Australia, which is not a religious institute, does not, is an organisation that provides a sporting experience for people, for them to then stipulate a certain sort of almost religious-like adherence to something, I think that's too far. I think that's kind of that's wrong. But
that sounds less like a hypothesis than Don's one. Like it might have happened.
Well, yeah. Oh. So I mean, considering that you don't join Rugby Australia in order to sort of as a your life is directed in a certain religious way to something, it's not going to be Rugby Australia or even a hospital, right? So that in those, there should be a religious freedom that is, you know, you can hold your religious beliefs. It is murky, and I'm not really sure how to sort of continue that articulation, but I think they are different. And so therefore you can't sort of say, oh, well, Rugby Australia or this hospital is the same as this Catholic church organization or something.
But they'll argue that it's a big part of their values and promotion. If you look at their, a lot of their marketing activity, they'll have rainbow colored banners and Rainbow Pride Day, and their Facebook will have for a month. Yeah, they'll have it's a big part of their marketing campaign. They'll argue it's a big part of their values. I'd argue, what's the role of a corporate and why are they plugging this? But that's beside the point. That's what they were arguing, and that's what they tried to argue in the Israel Folau case.
Mm. Mm.
This got very deep, Gavin.
Sorry about that. Right? I was thinking, ethical veganism, non-ethical carnivores.
The non-ethical carnivores did crack me up. The ethical veganism, I think it's good to get clarity what that was. So that was, I learned something there.
At least two things today.
This has been a learning podcast. I've learned many things. Don has been surprised. Pleasantly surprised. So it's good to know after nearly 150 episodes, we can still learn and surprise each other, and hopefully you too. And if you'd like to see if any of the previous episodes learn or surprise you, you can go check them out at www.station15.co.nz. You can subscribe there for free. I like how we say for free because we don't charge. But hey, look, there are stories in the offing in the podcast world, as podcasts are hitting the mainstream now, you see. And people are talking about how much longer will they be free for. Well, ours are still free, and you can subscribe to them there, or on iTunes or Google Play or Spotify. Just search for The 15th Station. If you want to reach out to us, we love hearing from you. podcast@station15.co.nz. Or you can reach us at facebook.com/station15 or twitter.com/station15. Don, thanks very much, mate, for making the time.
Thank you. And I had a taco.
And you had a taco. It was seamless too. Seamless. And I always love you to talk to you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Oh, thanks, James, for your emceeing extraordinaire.
Oh, thanks. Oh, aren't you kind? Aren't you kind? And you're kind too, Gavin, in your own kind way. Thank you, mate, for all your work, and thanks for making the time today.
Thanks, James. Always a pleasure.
It is indeed, and it's a pleasure to talk to all of you out there on the internet. We appreciate your listening to us. We hope that this has been a good podcast for you, and we look forward to talking to you next month. And until then, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.